Come with us now, if you dare, down a rickety staircase into a dank, dark basement. What awaits? The Saturday Night Freak Show.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Saturday Night Freak Show podcast, the movie and talk show podcast that comes your way every Saturday, whether you're ready for it or not, in our quest for total world domination, which you, yes, you, listener, right now are helping us out with. So thank you very much for playing along. These are the internet radio superstars.
Michaela.
Holly.
And I'm Colin. And tonight we watched a movie that was chosen by...
Holly. What did we watch tonight?
Tonight we watched a movie called Messiah of Evil.
Ooh, from the year?
1974, technically.
Okay.
Some say 73, 74.
Okay.
Yeah.
And directed by?
Written and directed by Will. Oh, I totally forgot. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's last name.
I think it's Hyuk.
Hyuk.
But that sounds...
Sounds fake.
Hyuk? Yeah,
Hyuk. Hoik?
Yeah, we should probably know this.
Willard Hyuk.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to say it.
I like Hyuk. I like that.
Hyuk. Yeah, so... Well...
Oh, yeah.
So I guess so, that is what kind of makes this movie notable.
Interesting. Of note. Yeah, this is the name that... Well, we're not familiar how to say it, apparently, but we're familiar with this name, especially on this show, because notoriously, we hate one of his movies.
I was going to say, Sean brought one of his movies, didn't he?
Sean brought one of his movies. The movie in question is Howard the Duck.
I knew it. Yep. I was like, I'm triggered by this name for a reason why. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, he wrote and directed Howard the Duck. I don't know why he did that, but
Howard the Duck, like, everybody, does everybody know Howard the Duck?
Everyone knows Howard
the Duck. Go listen to our
episode. Whether they've actually watched the actual movie or not is the question, but everyone knows what Howard the Duck is.
Because of Marvel, they brought him back, Marvel character back in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, that's how the current generation found out about it. But, I mean, other than that, like, everyone knew who it was.
We had the movie.
We had the movie.
Budget Lucasfilm movie.
Yeah.
That we did an episode on.
Yeah. We sure did.
Yeah.
Fucking hate that movie so much.
Sean made us watch that while we were in quarantine, too, so our mental state was already fragile, but, and we had to watch that.
Hyuk?
Let's go.
Hyuk. I don't Hyuk? Know. This is going to be a thing. Anyway, this dude has a thing with making movies that are well known that I feel guilty about hating.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hate Howard the Duck.
Okay.
I fucking hate that movie. I don't feel guilty about that.
Yeah.
You're saying as a director, because he's also notable as a screenwriter.
Yes, he is.
As a director.
Yes, he is. And because I hate American Graffiti.
Oh. Really?
He wrote that movie. I think it is the most boring ass movie.
Wait, did he write it by himself, though?
Yeah. He wrote the screenplay.
Wasn't it with his wife, Gloria Katz?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. We should talk about that. Gloria Katz is his wife and also co-writer, co-director, co-producer.
I guess because I always knew them as like a screenwriting duo.
Yes. They're a team. They do everything together. But I don't like American Graffiti. Mm-hmm. I think that movie's so boring.
Oh, wow.
I know it's a classic.
I think I've seen it like exactly once, so I kind of get where you're coming from.
I know it's a classic. I know there's amazing stars in it, and there's some great cars. There's some great costumes. There are good points about it. Yeah, music is amazing. I'll listen to the soundtrack all day long, but it is a boring-ass movie. Mm-hmm. It is.
An ode to the cruising subculture of the 1950s.
It's a nostalgia movie for not our generation.
For my dad.
My dad
loves that movie.
Because it came out in the 70s and it was looking back 20 years. Remember when we were kids and it was awesome?
That is my dad's Dazed and Confused.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But also, he wrote my least favorite Indiana Jones movie.
What? He wrote an Indiana Jones movie.
Temple of Doom.
Oh.
Okay. That is not, no longer is that my least favorite.
That's true.
Dial of Destiny.
Honestly, no. Dial of
Kingdom
Destiny.
Of the Crystal Skull.
Crystal Skull is the worst one.
Yeah.
I always forget to like count that.
Yeah.
To me, it like doesn't exist. I actually didn't hate Dial of Destiny.
Yeah. I didn't see it.
It wasn't offensively bad. Mm-hmm. Not great, but not offensively bad. But yeah, no. So this guy makes movies that I feel like I should be ashamed to admit that I don't like them.
But still, I mean, that's like, you know, like he's a major player that if he's written, you know, I mean, an Indiana Jones movie, you know, and American Graffiti. So he knew George Lucas. Did you hear that he also, him and his wife did script doctoring on Star Wars?
They did.
Nice.
And did you hear what their contributions were?
No, I didn't. What is this?
Well, according to internet legend, they, I think I found it on Gloria Katz's bio, but they contributed to the development of Princess Leia's character in on script doctoring on Star Wars.
Excellent contribution.
Okay, then. Yeah. That's love redeeming. That's very redeeming.
They gave her some humor. I guess that was Gloria Katz or whatever.
It worked out well.
Yeah. I'm glad. So, she needed it.
So they were in the, because I remember like they, you know, their names kept popping up in association with Lucasfilm projects.
Yeah.
This predates all of that, right? Predates American Graffiti and all of that.
It does.
So I assume they were students. Was it UCLA? That everybody like that was the film school. That was when that was like the first like film school. You went to school to figure out how to make movies. And this was like the first generation that
you go to UCLA.
If you watch Dawson's Creek, that is Dawson's entire storyline for the whole run of the series, is that he wants to go to UCLA because Spielberg went there and wants to learn be the next Steven Spielberg.
Spoiler, he drops out real quick.
Yeah. Like the first semester. Because he can't hack it.
But this is 1973 or whatever, 72, 73. It was shot.
Yeah, it was shot in 71.
Shot in 71. Yeah. Okay. And it's a horror movie.
It is a horror movie. It is a zombie movie.
Okay. Is it? Is that where it gets filed? Is like.
Yes.
There's a very heavy, like, Night of the Living Dead sense to the, like, inspiration.
It was released under multiple titles.
Okay.
Oh. Besides Messiah of Evil, it was also Dead People, Night of the Damned, Return of the Living Dead, and Revenge of the Screaming Dead.
Oh, those are all way worse.
Yeah.
Messiah of Evil is a great title.
It is a good title.
It is a good title.
It's a really good title.
Is it true?
No. No, it's not.
It could have been.
Messiah of Evil makes you think Satan is going to come back, or like a satanic cult going to revive something, or there's going to be some sort of reckoning.
They allude to the possibility of a Messiah of Evil in the lore that they depict in this movie.
Okay.
Does it deliver? We'll get there.
Well, this movie has kind of existed. I guess I'm trying to think how far back my awareness of it goes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I am not even sure, because I worked at a video store in the 90s, and we had a extensive horror film collection. And
you were Randy.
Don't recall. Yes. And I don't recall this one. It's like I became aware of it later once we started kind of restoring movies. And then there was like, we just were going back and restoring everything, finding all of these things from the past. And then it seemed like this kind of appreciation begins for Messiah of Evil that continues to this day, because I think recently I saw there was a screening maybe in Chicago.
I think so.
And then like I keep getting ads for the Night Flight. Night Flight from the 80s is returned as an app. And they're like, we have Messiah of Evil.
Yeah, I don't. It's so funny because you were talking about how it just all of a sudden ads start showing up for you. The same thing happened for me. Like, as soon as I announced that this was my next pick, Facebook was like, I got you. And all over my Facebook, I'm seeing all of these posts about this movie. And I'm reading the comments and all these people are like, it's the scariest movie I've ever seen. It's a cult classic. And I'm like, where did this come from? Like,
Colin and I went through this when Elvira did her special. Her 40th anniversary special a few years ago, where she did City of the Dead, also previous episode, and like two other movies. And the like fandom around this movie really showed up on the internet when Elvira really covered it.
So
there's definitely a cult following for this movie, for sure.
Well, I wonder, because there's several other movies that have a similar, it's like a tone or a sense about them. How do you describe, like, it's like an independent film, feels like it's maybe made by film students, mm-hmm. right? You there's a universe where like Halloween comes out of the same kind of, hey, we're going to make a movie sense that this one comes out of,
it
right?
It has that like first movie vibe for sure.
Yeah.
Less successful than Halloween, but mm-hmm. I mean, still remembered to this day. So, I mean, I suppose that is an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. But it has this kind of, all right, I'm going to say it's a movie made by hippies.
Yeah.
Is that true or false? Is that the sense you get from a lot of the movies that have you guys seen? Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
No, that's been on my list to bring this.
We've talked about
though.
It. Yeah. I have never actually watched it, but we have talked about that movie.
Okay. Yeah. How about The Witch Who Came from the Sea?
Yes, previous episode. Yes, you were not here for that one. Were you?
No, thankfully I was. Not.
You would not have liked that one.
But is there a shared vibe there? Yeah. Am I off?
This like 70s kind of like lo-fi art, but like artsy kind of hippie vibe to it. I get what you're saying.
Were you here for Lamora, the Child's Tale of the Supernatural? I'm just throwing some.
Not.
Like these are, they're like low budget. Do you remember that one?
I think I was here for that one.
Similar vibe or
yeah.
No? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the era that we're talking about, right? It's like these filmmakers are making these one-offs. A lot of them do seem to have some kind of, there's a lot of like indebtedness to, it feels like Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. It's an art house horror from the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they all go with the same thing. It's like there's ghouls that might be vampires.
Right. No, that's
that might be Satanists.
They might be zombies.
Yeah.
We never.
You can't shoot them and kill them. We know that.
And the rules are never clearly defined. I think that's what all these movies kind of have is that we're not really defining what our antagonist is, but like you can read it as one of those.
And I'm okay with that because I think it adds to the horror that there is no answer. There's no reasoning. There's no like lore to like explain what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's just happening. And I think that makes it scary.
Okay. Although there is lore in this movie that we're going to get into.
There's lore, but not about what the creatures are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or maybe what created them, mm-hmm. but not specific rules on what they are. So,
right.
The setting is a big part of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it take place?
At a beach house.
Yes. Okay, I was going with the larger, like, but you're right. Most of the movie does take place.
A small town.
Okay, and it's called Point Dune.
Point Dune.
Now, specifically.
Which is named after a California town.
Okay. Do you know where it was actually filmed?
Ooh, that's a good
If question. You were going to go try and check this place out.
You want to see the filming locations of
I feel like it's named after the town that it was filmed in. Like, it's a small town. It's something very similar to that.
Okay. Dune, that's D-U-N-E, right? Yeah. Yep. Sand dunes. We are told early on that it was originally named Bethlehem, mm-hmm. and it was renamed as Point Dune because of a 100-year-old superstition or story that involves a blood moon.
Blood moon, sure.
And the return of a dark stranger.
Like, mm-hmm. obviously.
Okay.
Small town lore. Everyone has that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right? I mean.
Yeah. We got Blood's Point. Yeah.
Blood's Point. We don't have a blood moon. We have Blood's Point. Yeah. There's a stranger, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be. Because I thought, you know, as we got into this, it was like some of it felt like Mormonism or something. The idea of, what was the guy's name who started, founded?
Joseph Smith.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Like coming out of the desert, and this guy mm-hmm. comes out of the sea and mm-hmm. like all that. So how does the movie get going? I think we had like a cold open that kind of just dropped mm-hmm. us into the horror.
Yeah, there's a cold open. It's just it's a man running down a sidewalk,
mm-hmm.
right? That was the cold open.
Yep, to a 70s pool,
which is a dope ass pool.
Yeah.
And then a lady comes out from the shadows by the pool,
but
and
she looks like maybe a little girl, but maybe a woman. You can't really tell.
And she slashes his throat.
Yep,
and cold open done.
Yeah. So I don't know what we get out of it. It's like he's running from something. What's he running from?
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. He's terrified. He's hot and sweaty. He has mm-hmm. to, you know, get some water on him. Then he lays down. She comes over and we're like, well, what is she like going to tend to him? Is he, you know, but then she slashes his throat in mm-hmm. some kind of unmotivated murder.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who is in this,
mm-hmm.
This is significant.
Oh, in this scene, yes. Yeah. Yes. The stabbing victim is Walter Hill. You may know as the director and writer of 48 Hours, Brewster's Millions, The Warriors.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Streets of Fire. Yep.
Well, that would mean that thanks to MF Mad, the keeper of the Saturday Night Freak Show Wall of Fame, he wants us to know that, yes, Walter Hill, because Messiah of Evil, The Warriors, and Streets of Fire has made it to the Saturday Night Freak Show.
I'm sad I wasn't here for Streets of Fire. What a movie. What a picture.
What a picture.
Yeah. Another one of those nostalgic look back on the 50s.
Yeah. With Willem Dafoe.
So, yeah. Michael Paré and a lot of rock and roll.
Yep.
We did
Dafoe
that one. Yeah.
Treasure.
Mm-hmm. He's also the producer of the Alien.
Yes.
Movie. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so
which is significant for a very important line in this movie.
Really? What?
Mm-hmm. They say it how many times? They say it the beginning and the end.
Pardon me, which line?
What was the exact wording? Because it's alien but not alien.
Oh. Yeah, that was his contribution to the Alien script. When he rewrote Dan O'Bannon's.
Oh yeah, no. In this, it's just no one will hear you scream.
Oh, and that became the tagline for Alien. Okay.
In space, no one will hear you scream.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. See, that's why you listen to the Saturday Night Freak Show. You find out where your favorite taglines.
We hear it in the beginning,
from.
And then we hear it multiple times at the end of the movie. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So introduced to the movie proper. Well, how do we get into the cursed town of Point Dune?
The arrival of, what's her name?
That lady drives.
Arletty.
Yeah. Okay.
Drives up to a gas station.
Yeah. And we recognized her here on the Saturday Night Freak Show as an alumni because she was, what's the actress's name? Mariana Hill.
Mariana Hill.
Mm-hmm. Who was also in.
Godfather Part 2.
Well, we didn't cover the Godfather part.
Oh, well, what did we cover?
She was one of the Corleones, I think, in the Godfather.
She was, yeah.
She was Burt Reynolds' girlfriend and was she? No, maybe that was the other. She was in The Baby.
Oh, that's right. I'm still trying to block it out. Even though we talked about it while watching this, I'm still trying to block
the
it out.
The notorious The Baby.
Yeah, yeah, note that I didn't note it in my notes.
Yes.
What happens in the baby's room?
Ugh, God.
Nothing. The baby.
I've never
nothing
seen
that you
anything
need to
like
witness.
That. Yeah.
Nothing happens in that room or movie that you need to witness.
Yeah. So she's in this movie. She's the star, right? And so she arrives at a gas station and strange shit is already going down.
Yeah. The gas station attendant's just shooting into the darkness outside this gas station, which if I saw this, I can wait till the next gas station. I'm moving along, especially because it seems like it's one of those places you can't pump yourself.
Yeah, it's a full service back in the 70s.
I was like, back then, were there any places you could pump yourself?
No.
I don't think there was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's shooting at...
says wild dogs.
And I like that it's like a full-fledged mobile.
Yeah.
It's branded. It's a mobile gas station.
Full-fledged mobile.
Mm-hmm. And then... things get weirder because an albino trucker shows up.
Correct. Yes.
And in the gas station attendant discovers that in the back of his flatbed are bodies.
With their throat slit.
And I think their eyes.
Yeah, their eyes are missing. Yeah.
And so then he becomes the target and eventual victim of the albino, I assume. I don't know who killed him, but he dies in a stalk and slash sequence in the.
But he's like not panicking.
Right.
Right. He's just like, I'm still going to pump your gas. Like he's not nervous that he's just discovered these dead bodies in the back. Of
he
the
tells her, he's like, get out of here. Go, tells her to split once he notices the bodies. So
we've had a couple of scenes now just like launching us into this where we don't understand the motive. There's a danger. There are people who are killing other people. Motive unknown. She's coming into this. Why? Because she's going to Point Dune and the gas station attendant. Of course, it's one of those things where it's like, nobody goes to Point Dune. Is it Point? Am I saying that right?
I think so, yeah.
Pleasant Dune. It was Point Dune.
Point Dune, yeah.
Okay, because it's on the sea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why is she traveling to this location?
She's looking for her father. who is apparently missing.
And what do we know about her father?
All we know is that he's an artist.
A seemingly painter. An eccentric artist, yeah. Yeah.
But well known.
Well known, because yeah.
They know him at the art gallery.
Yes.
Even though there's weird reality things going on here, she says that she, you know, the owners of the art gallery, one of whom's blind at the painting.
Blind and mute.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But blind and mute art dealer.
Art dealer,
it's important,
yeah.
Art dealer. So this person is supposed to know taste and curate it and recommend it to other people.
And what I want to point out, that this is clearly a commentary on the art world that I don't entirely disagree with.
Yeah, yeah.
Being an artist myself, and Michaela can agree.
Yeah.
Like, there's some bullshit people in charge.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that this scene, like, this lady has such a short appearance in this part of the movie, but they take so many slams at her in this one scene, because, first of all, there's the blind and mute part, but then she feels Arletty's face.
Yeah.
And Arletty says in, like, the narration, her hands felt my space like face like a pale spider. And I'm like, damn, you all are just going in on that. I mean, she does seem to suck, but yeah. She like, does. Wow. Unnecessary commentary, I feel like.
I like the turn of phrase in this movie.
Yeah.
I like the wording.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is delivered by voiceover.
Right.
It is.
A yeah. lot of it is delivered is by voiceover. So
it's very like noir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. The well, I don't disagree with that, because yeah, I mean, it does the okay. So the, I guess this is the elephant in the room about this movie that I have a question about. Oh. Did it seem to you, because this is how it played to me,
okay,
that a lot of scenes were filmed silent, right, just to get something, and they were from a different like idea or thing that we had shot, and then as filmmakers, and then we edited it all together, and we used extensive use of voiceover to cover it over, make it seem like it all fit as part of the same movie.
Yeah, and we also, when we don't know how to transition from one scene to another, just put in a shot of the waves crashing on the beach.
Yeah.
Good God.
With extensive voiceover yes. to cover it.
Oh my God, so many, and I think it's the same shot most of the time of the waves yeah. crashing on the
I
beach.
I think a lot of the voiceover is a vehicle for that, but I think some of it is intentional, because a lot of the scenes are reading her father's diary.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the voiceover is intentional. But not all of it. I think some of it is a tool, like yeah, you're saying.
I think those are the two main narrations that we get.
Yeah.
We get her narration of the present day events, and then mm-hmm. we get his narration as she reads through these diaries and echoes through her head of what happened in the town leading up to the moment that she got mm-hmm. there. But mm-hmm. it did, I guess, I don't know. I'm curious to know like how much of this was actually scripted when they went into it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it took years and they filmed this and that and the mm-hmm. other thing. And then they couldn't figure out how to fit it all together and then made it all up in the editing room. I don't mm-hmm. know. I mean, in some ways it felt like that. Mm-hmm. But then there were yeah. other scenes and long stretches where it was like, well, clearly they intended for all of this stuff to link together.
Yeah. And you know that the dad's voiceover was intentional just because of who they chose for the voice of Joseph Lang.
Yeah, her dad. Yeah.
Yeah. Royal Dano.
Yeah.
Was Joseph Lang. If you don't know, Royal Dano was the voice of Lincoln at the Hall of Presidents in
nice.
Disney.
Yeah. A longtime cowboy yeah. actor.
Oh, yeah. He's been in tons of stuff, but he is the voice of Lincoln.
Well, we've seen him on this show. Is he on the Saturday Night Freak Show Wall of Fame? Let me consult. I think he already is.
Yeah.
I know we did. Did we do Ghoulies 2? He's in Ghoulies 2.
You have to ask Sean about that one.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, yeah. He is in that. So.
He's been in so many things, but the one that I always kind of respected Royal Dano for was because he was an old guy in 1987 or 88 when he played Gramps in House 2,
uh-huh.
the second story, in full body makeup, you know? I mean, I had to be, I think his last role was in The Dark Half. He was like yeah. a gravedigger or something in The Dark Half. But
it's pretty tedious roles for someone that...
To be right. that much yeah, like right. full... You know, prosthetics is one of the main yeah. you know characters in House 2. It's not a good movie, but no. you know,
great title though. House 2, the second story. Yeah. Oh my God, that's genius! I love it. It love that.
Yeah,
that was pretty
yeah.
good.
Yeah,
but he plays her dad. Like he's actually in the movie. Eventually, yes. he does show yeah. up, but narrates quite a bit of it. There's what happened in the past, which we hear once she actually finds his stuff. But then there's other characters that we meet in the present day. Which way do you want to go first?
Right. So at the gallery, she asks, you know, my dad is a painter. He's Joseph Lang. I'm just wondering if you know him. And they're very snotty about it. They're very much like, oh, yeah, just because we're a gallery, we should know every artist. And she's like, well,
This is why certain artist types suck right here. Perfect example of like a gatekeeping asshole for no reason.
I agree. And then he goes on to say, but of course we've heard of him. He's in magazines. We can read. And it's like, you just gave her shit
right
that she thinks you know him. And now you're saying you do know who he is. Yeah. And it's just stupid. And then he says, oh, by the way, there was other people in here earlier looking for him. And it's like, you know what, you son of a bitch.
Just answer my fucking question the first time, you know?
Like, don't give me shit for asking, and then you give me shit because you do know, and then you give me more shit because I'm not the only one looking for him. Like, everything about this guy, I wanted to punch him in his weaselly face. Mm-hmm. Just made me really mad. But also, yeah, it's a horrible, accurate look into the world of art.
Well, he leads them to...
You take your lighthouse paintings and shove it.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I was saying there was some maybe reality shifting things later, because the people that she meets who are looking for her dad say that, oh, yeah, there was a painting of his in that gallery, but they said it wasn't for sale. And she's like, but there were no paintings of my dad there. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, who do we believe at this point? Like, the whole thing is kind of, the narrative is, who do you trust? What's real and what isn't? Mm-hmm. Is the whole thing a nightmare? Mm-hmm. If so, who's having it? Maybe we'll answer those questions. So, anyway, she has led to three visitors, vacationers, travelers to the town who are also here. And this is some guy named Tom. He's a well-dressed fellow, right? And his two female companions, whose names I have escaped me.
No idea.
Tony and Laura.
Tony and Laura. I did look up. I looked up some trivia about the
lady. Michael Greer.
No, but tell me, that's Tom, okay?
Michael Greer played Tom. He is an important figure because he was one of the first openly gay actors in Hollywood.
Oh, cool.
Love that. Mm-hmm. And he played a gay landlord in the movie The Gay Deceivers from 1969. Nice. I don't know if you know this one. I've actually seen this movie. It's two dudes are pretending to be gay so that they can dodge the army.
Oh, I love it.
But their landlord is actually gay. Like,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, God, who is in that? I didn't even write it down, but it's a funny movie. But, yeah, so that's Tom, Michael Greer.
And Anita.
Anita Ford.
Anita Ford.
Yeah.
Who plays one of his, Laura. She was one of the first models on The Price is Right.
Yes, she was. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And she had a pretty extensive career on The Price is Right.
Yeah, and some movies. She was in The Big Birdcage, I think, was one of them.
Do you think being a Price is Right model pays well?
No.
No? Do you think you at least get, like, the showcase showdown that loses or something? Or, like, the prize, like, the blenders people can't, you know, win in the fucking knockout game or something, you know?
I would hope
A discount on Maytag appliances?
I mean, I don't think in the 70s they were paid very well, but I would like to think that they're paid decent now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know? As the show becomes more popular, I'm sure their contracts go up every time.
I could watch Price is Right forever. Dude, it never gets old.
I love that show.
Never. Well, so these three folks and then the third girl is she's constantly referred to as like a child. She's the younger one.
Yeah.
We're assuming, I don't know, I kind of got like hippie vibes. They have nowhere to go and nothing to do, right? I think Tom he says his family was aristocrats or whatever. He has money. And so the two girls are just kind of kicking around with him, and they're just bumming around Southern California. We assume they're all having sex with each other at some point.
I'm not going to lie. It sounds kind of awesome.
But it doesn't make for the most interesting movie, because it's just them laying around a lot. And just like feels like they're waiting for something to happen, and I'm waiting for something.
They are waiting for the viewer.
Yes, because we're told that Tom is a collector of mythology or something like that, or of stories, and so he's basically come to Point Dune because he's heard the story of the Blood Moon and the return of the Dark Stranger, and so he just kind of wants to soak up the atmosphere. And so to do that, when we first meet them, it's all very strange.
It's
in a hotel room with Elijah Cook Jr., who we are inducting to the Saturday Night Freak Show Wall of Fame. So there you go. You didn't know there was going to be two, but Elijah Cook Jr., he was in The Haunted Palace that we did. And he was in Blackula and A Messiah of Evil.
All right. Cool.
You would know this guy if you've seen like 70s, you know.
He has a very familiar face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the guy, the disembodied head, right? At the beginning of The House on Haunted Hill that comes out. And yeah, all those great William Castle movies and Roger Corman stuff, all Elijah Cook Jr. But he's like the town drunk.
I feel like everyone in this movie has like a little bit of a story to him. Even the gas station attendant was in Butch Cassidy and The Sting.
Awesome. Yeah. So it's not like they're, you know, I mean, I guess... It's like, how do you explain like this, what this movie feels like is like, these are, you know, I guess film students who, because you're in the you're in California, like you're getting all these actors just kind of on their off day to come over and do something. And not like they're famous or anything, but like they have a body of work. I mean, they're working actors, and it wasn't beneath them to do this, like what feels like a student film, you know? To at least come and put a day in. But Elijah Cook Jr. is in this, and he is the town drunk giving like the lore of the Dark Stranger. What is the story? What happened 100 years ago?
Right. I have to get past him talking about the chickens and being born on a farm, because that's how he starts.
Yeah, he remembers his own birth, right? Apparently. My mother reached down between her legs and pulled out me as a bloody mess, and
it's really gross. I'm
glad I don't remember my own birth. I'm just gonna say that
most people like, are glad for that.
But like, have you noticed that's kind of like a flex in like movies? Sometimes people say that, like, there was another movie and I don't remember what it was where some kid said that he remembered his own birth.
Was it the butterfly effect?
Probably. Yes. But like, why would you want to remember that?
You wouldn't.
Yeah. No, like, it's not
horrifying.
If you're a person that can remember that, just keep that information to yourself, because nobody wants to hear it.
Also, you're imagining it.
Yeah. There was some scientific research on this or something that I read, so I'm hoping it's not just me talking out my ass. But the idea of a drug acid trip, right, is the intensity that kind of happens, that peaks, right, and then dissipates, is actually somehow related to you remembering being born.
Huh. That sounds like something someone on acid came up with.
It does.
Yeah, because I mean, here's the thing with psychedelics is everything feels like a religious experience.
Yeah.
So if you even have any sort of vague feeling like you're experiencing that, I can see how you could convince yourself of that. You know, it's very easy to convince yourself of anything when you're on psychedelics. So
were the people who wrote this movie on psychedelics?
No, because it would be more interesting if it was. And it would have more visual appeal too.
What is the drug that we think they were taking when they wrote this movie? I was going to go with marijuana. Is it a stoned movie?
It does, because it has that lazy energy.
It does have that lazy. Yeah.
And everything, I think they thought when they were writing it down, it was all symbols and it was very deep. It means something more.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah.
It's like that episode of Family Guy when Lois and Peter are a folk singing duo and they think they're amazing, and then it's just because they're stoned. It shows them when when they're actually singing, like they just sound ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's the same effect.
I think so. I think that actually kind of that like lays over all these movies from this era that we're talking about. And it feels like they were all written when everybody was really high.
This is like genius.
Yeah. So these three travelers, right, who they have a meet weird. It's very uncomfortable.
Very.
But then they end up kind of just freeloading in her house.
Right. Apparently, because she goes looking, apparently the people at the gallery tell her where to find these people that were also looking for her dad. She shows up. They're in the middle of listening to a weird homeless dude tell stories about his own birth. And
And what actually happened? We never, I guess, told the folks at home that. What is the 100-year story?
Right. So it all is based around the blood moon, that a dark stranger shows up to town. In this case, it was like in the middle of the wilderness, you know, before it was all developed. So it's like a trapper came across him, or a hunter or whatever came across this dark stranger. And in talking to the Dark Stranger, the hunter finds out that he had spent time with the Donner Party.
Mm-hmm.
And
had, that's how he came to this side of the Rockies.
Yeah, exactly. And he had experienced eating human flesh.
Okay.
He walks through the fire and like attacks him. But he is like animalistic when he attacks him. And
they make cat sounds.
They make cat sounds. They
unexplained.
But like
strange.
Yeah.
Why do they make cat sounds when they're always saying, oh, it's just wild dogs. It's just wild dogs. Like,
yeah, they keep saying wild dogs and then it sounds like a fucking MGM lion. Yeah. Like, what are you doing?
Right.
Pick a side.
Exactly. Like, at least have some cohesiveness with your details here.
I mean, I guess they just want it to sound like a beast in general.
But it sounds like cats, yeah.
It goes back and forth and it's very strange.
But have we ever gotten a real deal, like, Donner Party movie? I would love one.
I think they're out there, but they're not, but like a, not like a good one. Major
like not
one.
A TV made for TV movie. Like give me like
The Revenant, but the Donner Party.
The Revenant. Right, I was going to say The Hateful Eight, but like The Revenant. Give me like a prestige. Get me like eight of the like most famous people right now to be in like a Donner Party movie.
We did have Alive, the story of the plane of soccer players.
The soccer players, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. We did have
Ethan
that.
Ethan Hawke, was he in that one? Am I right?
I never saw that.
Yeah.
Shit, maybe I need to watch that.
So, but I guess this is like the issue that I had was that I guess I you know there was some menace to these three people, right? Mm-hmm. I thought, because they just kind of show up and they're like, we're just going to stay at your house, and she's like uncomfortable with them being there, right? Mm-hmm. She's like, I'm on a mission to find my dad, and that's like all I want to do.
But they're like, the homeless guy was found dead and now no one will take us in. We need a place to stay.
Yeah. So you're like, did they kill the homeless guy after she spoke with him? Because he warns her, like, when you find your pappy, you're going to have to light him on fire. You know, he's been taken over by the, I don't know, your daddy, I think, but he's been taken over by the evil of this town.
Yeah. You can't bury him. You got to burn him.
Yeah. Because I think the stranger is supposed to return on a new blood moon. That's happening now, apparently. Mm-hmm. And so his influence is corrupting the town. The townspeople, when we do see them, because mostly this town appears as like a deserted town.
Right.
But they meet out on the beach and light fires as they are waiting, watching the moon and waiting for this guy to come back out of the water. Mm-hmm. This is very H.P. Lovecraft.
For sure. But this makes you think you're going to see some cool ritual, maybe satanic shit. No. This is it. This is the quote-unquote ritual of standing there and staring.
Did you get a lot of... This movie employs, probably because it is a low budget, but there's a lot of scenes where characters are telling you about the big action scene that happened. Right. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of our time in the house and just in kind of these quiet dialogue scenes. But all the folks are telling us about, like, I was chased down the road by a bunch of, you know, whatever. And then somebody kind of like that scene in Night of the Living Dead where Ben explains, you know, that he was being chased on the truck. And you see that in your head. But that didn't actually happen in the movie.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what this movie's trying to do is like build another movie in your mind. Other than what you're actually watching.
Pretty much,
But it turns out, and I said this is kind of why I had an issue with it. It took me a little while to figure out, like, oh, Tom and his two ladies, they're like the normies in this movie that are our protagonists. And then I saw at the end, it was like Michael Greer was the lead character. And I'm like, I thought Mariana Hill was the lead.
Yeah.
No, it's actually... He's the star of the movie.
Yes.
And so it's actually about him and his, you know, trying to marshal these women around him, keep them safe from, even though he brought them into harm's way.
Mm-hmm. It's very Hitchcock, isn't it?
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily even work that way. You know, when you're watching it, I didn't get that impression. So tell me about, so she goes to the house. Tell me about the house, because it's...
This is like the big set piece of this show or this movie, whatever. This is a cool house.
It is a cool house.
It's like almost kind of castle-esque, but it's like a painter's studio on the beach. And it's just really cool. Like there's murals everywhere and all these different styles of art, and it's very
there's like a big round bed.
Yeah, there's a big round bed with lots of like satin pillows and stuff, but then there's also like a suspended bed.
Okay, we gotta talk about this bed, because we spent a lot of time talking about this bed when we were watching it, because this bed is like a supporting character in the movie.
Yeah,
it really gets featured a lot.
Really, although no sex on the bed.
No sex on the bed. Given the design of this bed, I would have liked to see it, you know?
I kept thinking about it. I'm like, how would
you? Because it's like a sex swing and a bed in one. Because
how would it? Yeah.
It's like this big white wood plank, it looks like. They're like very modern looking with these white chains suspending it from the ceiling, but it's like tight enough that it just sways slightly.
Yeah.
So it's the upgraded version of a waterbed, basically, because.
And the funny thing is that it is a platform, and it's a big platform that like it's huge, bigger than the mattress.
Yeah.
So there's like a border around it. And there's different things that like
houseplants
appear on it. Like at one point, there's a record player on it.
Which I was curious, how is the power getting?
Like the plants kept moving. There'd be different plants on it. Yeah. And I was like,
but this room like also like only has three walls and faces like a balcony that overlooks the ocean. So you can lay on this swaying bed and look at the ocean. Yeah,
big ass fireplace. Hell yeah. This house is so cool.
Yeah,
yeah. And the murals are a lot of like forced perspective.
Yeah,
humanoid characters. Mm-hmm. You know, they're people, but they're represented in a way that's like not entirely defined. That makes sense.
And I don't think there were supposed to be anyone, but I'm pretty sure one of them may have been styled after Nixon and one of them after Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, okay.
Because they looked very similar.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't think they wanted them to look exactly like it, but I feel like that was kind of their reference point for that.
I mean, it does add a significant amount to the movie, the production design of this interior house. You know, it's very colorful.
Technically speaking, like this movie has a lot of flaws, but visually, there's a lot of really cool stuff in this movie.
Yeah. From the lighting work inside there and, you know, everything. It's like it has a distinct, you know, I mean, it's very 70s, but it has a distinct, like, visual look to it.
I guess I'm
less in the photography, more in the production design.
I mean, some of the photography, but there's definitely a vision for this movie, and it comes through pretty obvious, but like it's a cool vibe. This movie's a vibe.
Yeah,
it's definitely a vibe.
So the main gist of the movie then is gonna find these characters kind of, well, no, okay,
right, so now each character has to be has to basically fall victim to the cult or people or whatever they are, because we don't know what they are,
because that's what's going on, right?
Yeah,
we see a lot of like I guess they're well-dressed folks, they're all in suits and dresses.
I don't know if this is true, but I saw something that said that it was a lot of the extras in this movie were played by unemployed NASA employees
because of where they shot it.
That's what I read. Okay. I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah. But
sure, why not? I'll believe it.
I think it's
a harm in believing
it. If it's true, it's fun.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But they have, I mean, I guess you're also setting up that kind of like, you know, anti-establishment vibe with the, you know, the well-dressed people going after the four hippies in town, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's that the man or authority or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all ghouls. They bleed from the eyes
and the ears.
That's how you know that they're affected by the curse.
Yeah, right.
We're told through the voiceover, because apparently her father has gone through this. He's missing, right? But he left his
diary.
And so in his diary, he's explaining basically the steps that he's going through. He doesn't feel pain anymore.
Right.
He's seeing all these creatures that can't be real.
But he's having like visions aside from that. And yeah.
Yeah. So he's like losing his mind. Mm-hmm. Then he loses his faculties. He starts bleeding.
At one point he like rips his own finger off.
Yeah.
He
doesn't even feel it.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, this is foreshadowing. We're setting up somebody's eventual transformation into this, which we assume is going to be one of our main characters.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I felt, the subplot, which never, I thought, resolved itself, was the sexual tension between, like, Tom has two women, and now here's the third that, you know, and the other women kind of feel this, you know, like they're now second banana to his latest conquest. And there is this swinging bed and it never kind of...
I know, there's a big satin-covered bed and a swinging bed, and there's three women to the one dude. You'd think there's going to be some decent sex in this movie.
Or, you know, does the seduction pay off? Because it seems like he's trying to seduce her, like, the entire way through the movie, and mm-hmm. you're like, well, where is this going?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it goes nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Although, logically speaking, I get it.
Right. Because what was his opening line? It was pretty good.
Oh, his zipper was stuck.
I need you to help me with something.
Yeah, my zipper's stuck. Can you help me? But it was like his vest zipper.
Yeah, which like I was like, this is a new pickup line. I don't hate it, but I also am like, wow, you're just cutting right to the chase on this one. But then, yeah, and so you think it's going to be the pant zipper. No, it is. He's wearing a vest and he wants the side of it on one yeah. side unzipped.
Yeah, this vest consists of buttons in the front and a zipper on each side.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what does it come off over his head?
I've never seen this.
Does it go on like a bib?
It goes on. You just, instead of zipping it down the front, you zip it down the side.
But it had a zipper on each side, I thought.
It had a zipper on each side and buttons.
Yeah, so it goes on like a smock and then you fucking... zip it up on each side. But like, also, dude, you can unzip that yourself. This is a weak ass pickup line. Like,
yeah.
But also, she unzips it and he doesn't take it off.
Well, so. You don't leave a man unzipped and, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then they just like embrace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they don't even kiss.
Yeah.
I know. And then he's like,
and it's like, this is
respectful.
Right,
he's like, you're tired. I'm tired too.
We're both tired.
Good night. Yeah. And so you're like, ooh, but later. Tension. Right. Yeah. But the other two girls, they're not having this.
Right.
The first girl, Anita Ford, she's like, I'm out of here. And so she hikes out into the night on her own mm-hmm. and gets a ride with the albino.
The albino from the beginning, yeah.
Who it turns out has been catching rats and eats them. One here. I'll eat it. Would you like one? I have more. She's like, no. Jumps out of there. There's a bunch of people in the back of the truck.
That all are just staring up at the moon.
Very weird.
Very weird. This is a very creepy scene.
And she's left off in town, which is deserted, and she sees someone, and she follows her to a Ralph's grocery store.
It's the
store.
Same girl from the beginning of the movie, isn't it?
Is it?
I think so.
Okay. The little girl. Who lured Walter Hill to his death. Mm-hmm. And so in the Ralph's grocery store.
Yeah, which is open for some reason. I don't know why it's open at like 12 at night. But
where we ended up, like a lot of this movie, sorry, my interest was looking at all the prices and stuff.
Yeah, 100%. We want to know how much
we're doing. Yeah, inflation calculators while we were watching this.
It was
a sweater for $2.99 at Ralph's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they go to the movies, the popcorn is 50 cents.
Yeah.
But you figured out like the $2.50 sweater was actually how much?
A $21 sweater, $21. Which is still a really good deal. So
it was a good deal.
But she finds a bunch of people just snacking in
I feel like this is a pretty iconic scene. If you've heard anything about this movie, you've probably seen a clip of this scene.
I think this is, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are they doing? They're eating at
it's a bunch of people standing around the meat,
the butcher counter.
Yeah, the butcher counter. Yeah, thank you. And just chowing down on raw meat.
And we're like, ew, what the? And then they notice that she's there and pursue her and, of course, gang up on her. And then very George Romero-like descend upon her and apparently rip her apart and eat her.
Mm-hmm.
Cannibals.
Yeah.
Because of the dark stranger.
Yeah.
Right? This is his new religion, cannibalism. I'm not entirely sure what's going on there. There was talk of old gods coming back because we're in a faithless time and now it'll turn to the old gods. That's when he'll reappear.
Mm-hmm.
The messiah of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Don't expect that from this movie though.
So the other girl, the younger one, she eventually, has enough of this. It's like, you're waiting to,
yeah, because he's like, hey, why don't you take the car and go to the movies? She's like, I get to drive the car and go to the movies. And then she realizes that he's just trying to get rid of her and all the joy leaves her face.
Mm-hmm. You still get to go to the movies,
go to the movies, and drive a sweet car.
Right.
I know, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is not a bad bad gig. What does she go to see?
Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye?
but then the movie is what? Something with the West,
Gone
right?
with the West?
Well, that was the trailer before the movie.
Okay.
Okay.
That was the previews, yeah.
Okay.
It's a Western that we're
with
watching.
Sammy Davis Jr., yeah.
The so this is the theater when she arrives is basically deserted. It doesn't look unlike modern movie theaters.
Right, but there was something that stuck out to us, which we had a big discussion about, is there is one guy sitting up in the front row of this movie theater, even though most of the seats are open.
Yeah.
Listeners, when was the last time you had to sit in the front row or the second row because the theater was so packed? I think the last time that happened to me was like a Star Wars movie.
Probably.
And I want to know, I want to know if there's any of you crazies out there that like the front row.
Right.
Are you that person? Is there that person anymore?
It's really bad in IMAX. That's hell. Yeah.
You just want the movie to wash over you. Yeah. You want the full experience. Front row. You are only used to be in the front row if you got trapped there. There was nowhere else to go.
I think when I saw Oppenheimer, it was pretty much packed, and there was people in the front row, and I was like, oh my god, wow, that was weird. Sucks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although there is the story of all the acid heads in 1968 that would go and lay down in the front row and watch 2001 A Space Odyssey, so they would start tripping by the time they got to the Stargate sequence.
I mean, I get that.
Yeah.
So she's in the movie theater, mm-hmm. and slowly it fills in behind her with all of the denizens of Point Dune, and then they respectfully wait until the movie's over to attack her, but she can't get out. And the doors are locked.
Do they wait for the movie to be over?
Yeah, the movie ends, the lights come up, and then they all attack her. They didn't do anything before that, and you're like, we're waiting for something.
There's so much footage of people coming in one by one through these doors and sitting down in the movie theater. It goes on for so long.
I like the idea of this scene, mm-hmm. but it does go on for too long. Yep. It's like, okay, we get what you're doing.
Especially because we don't need to see everybody walk in. You show one person walking in, you cut to a close-up of her, you cut to a wide shot, and there's like five more people. Cut to a close-up of her, cut to another wide shot, there's 10 people.
Yeah.
You know, like that's how Alfred Hitchcock would do it, right?
Yeah.
Like that scene in The Birds when the crows land and they pan out and you see there's like hundreds of them.
Yeah,
that's how you do that, you know?
Yeah, the shock that there's more.
Yeah.
But we watch them all file in and eventually they attack her and apparently eat her alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now we're down to two characters left in the movie. At some point, there is like a whole thing with like the police find a body that is supposed to be her father and they lead her down to the beach where he was working on an art installation that collapsed
on him. And she's like, I don't know why they lied to me. Those weren't his hands.
So it's not her father. She's right. Her father shows up eventually, but he has been taken over by the thing. Now, his whole motivation for her, right, appearing at this point in the movie, is I told you not to come here. But since you did, I want you to leave here and tell everyone in the outside world what is happening in Point Dune, because they're going to come from the sea and then travel down the coast and invade the cities.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's that's the ultimate plan here. That's going to happen.
Yeah, this you shouldn't have come, but since you're here, you know, spread the word.
Then he attacks her.
Well, like you do. Yeah.
And then there's a big fight with paint.
Yes.
Yes.
And turpentine. Yep.
Yeah. And it's not just like her pushing him into paint. It's like him going nuts and just throwing paint around and putting paint on himself.
On his face,
On his face.
Throwing it all over the wall.
Yeah, it's more or less just him having a fit and putting paint on himself.
Yeah.
Yep. I know a lot of people that would do this as a performance piece.
That's what it feels like. But see, this also kind of leads me to, because when you said before that the inclusion of the blind art dealer was kind of a comment on art, well, not art criticism, but like the art, art scene.
Art hierarchy.
So I see what you're saying. So because the movie, so they're not criticizing that, like the art itself is like a blind person could sell it. It's more that the people who are in charge of art don't know anything about what they have, because the movie makers are trying to make an art film, right? I mean, like that is the whole thing. So that would be contradictory if they were.
Right. Because if you go to like these like snooty galleries like they show in this movie, it's all like the beach paintings, and which don't get me wrong, you know, beach
painting
can be good.
There's a place for them. Yeah.
Beach painting can be good, but it's all like the very, like it's like Thomas Kinkade kind of stuff, you know, like it's going to be
hotel art.
Hotel art, you know. And but this stuff sells for crazy amounts of money. And that's the commentary that something unique and original is not going to sell, but you're going to buy a lighthouse for thousands of dollars. And a blind person could sell it.
Right. So don't watch the blockbusters. Watch the indie movies like Messiah and Evil, which are actually real movies.
We were actually just saying something similar to that before we started recording.
We really were. Yeah.
We were talking about not seeing remakes or sequels in theaters to stop perpetuating them. Yeah.
I mean, so yeah. I guess it's a good thing that they're out there making their individual art, even though yes. it might be impenetrable to try and determine what's actually going on. What does this movie say about, I mean, if it's a movie that seems to be concerned so much about art, there's characters who are artists and, you know, collectors supposedly of art. Like, what is the general?
I mean, I think you're right in thinking that this movie may have been created by people who are kind of hippies, because I think they're very much talking about the art itself, the artist, the spirit behind the art, the heart behind it, you know. So I think it's a commentary on originality, I think, is what it's.
But is it saying that, well, it's not saying that the art creates a like the communicable disease of evil.
No.
Because he's missing. The artist became part of the, against his will, became part of it. And so he wants someone who's outside of that to go, like, warn everybody.
I mean,
coming. So I'm like, I'm missing.
No, I think there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of symbolism here. I think they're saying, like, if you conform, you're going to be part of the problem. So you're just going to fall in with the rest of the zombies.
Okay.
But if you go out there and like put out your original art and your original thoughts and everything, then you're going against that. I think that's the symbolism they were going for here.
Like, it's a counterculture. It's trying to be a counterculture.
It is. Movie, yeah. Which
feels very appropriate for the time. So
for sure.
But yeah, I just don't know that it fully delivers it as clearly as
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I was like, I see what I think they're trying to do. Right. I don't think it was communicated as well as they wanted.
Right.
And I never finished it because I couldn't get into it, but isn't that kind of what Velvet Buzzsaw was going for, right?
Yes.
But in a much more in-your-face way.
Very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't care for that movie. I mean, I never finished it, but
It wasn't my favorite.
No. No. It's too bad. There was potential there.
I'm still trying to, like, even unpack the imagery that we see at the end of this movie. Tom is killed by, because eventually the ghouls invade the house.
Right. They invade the house.
They tear it apart and they come in there. And
they come through the windows, the skylight. They ruin the beautiful skylight.
They all jump one at a time through the skylight and let out their tiger scream, which is just like, I do like the imagery of the silhouettes through the skylight.
I love that.
It's cool.
Yeah.
But they make it comical by the way they handle it.
I agree. Like,
they kind of take the wind out of their sails, but anytime they do have scary imagery in this movie.
I agree. Yeah.
And eventually dad is lit on fire and he's burned.
Yes. That was before Tom even came back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And she is bleeding from the eyes and is poking herself with needles and is not feeling anything.
So she's having all of the same side effects that her dad was having.
Right.
Yeah.
So Tom comes back. She stabs him. Then apparently she's apologized. And so he's like, we got to get out of here. And so they wander down the beach. Mm-hmm. But the crazy people are still following them. This is they're branching out, right?
Yeah, they've come down to the beach to prepare for the moon watching.
Yeah. And now we're caught, you know, in that. Mm-hmm. Tom is killed.
Yeah, so there's nowhere to go because they're surrounded. So they go to the sea. They start kind of like swimming to try to get out to a boat.
Oh, that's right. He drowns.
He drowns, yeah, because they're swimming and she turns and he's gone.
Yeah. And then there's a scene where she goes underwater, but the narration is like, but they didn't let me drown. This is where they're making the movie up as they go.
Yep.
And instead, they brought me to the rocks and they put me in a
gown.
And the dark stranger did appear. And
gave
we see
her Bonnie Tyler hair.
Right.
Her hair was huge all of a sudden.
Because it seems like it's from a different, like they shot it some other time later, or this was part of a bigger scene.
So my understanding is that there was the scenes of the Messiah that we did get that. And there's a part when we're hearing the story about the dark stranger coming. And I was like, that looks like Tom. It was. That was supposed to be
like a resurrected Tom. Because he couldn't have been the dark stranger the whole time.
He was supposed to be.
Because it doesn't make any sense.
Which is why it was cut.
Okay.
But yeah, Tom was supposed to be the dark stranger. This is my understanding.
Returning to the town after.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make any sense.
Because
I
know.
Okay. So with that subplot cut out,
yeah,
the implication is that she's in a bridal.
And the Dark Stranger is supposed to be the son of Satan.
Okay. So. And she and I assume then we were supposed to get some kind of like the dark mating and the birth of the Antichrist or the Anti-Cthulhu or whatever.
I think maybe they just didn't know where they're going with it.
So they delete that. They use voiceover that all of a sudden she's in a garden setting and she's painting. I think that's significant, right? She's become the painter that her dad and she's like, but they let me go with the idea that I was going to be the one who was supposed to tell the story. But they knew that no one would believe me. And so she's in a mental hospital. Painting. We never get to see what she's painting because that was, I think,
it really bugs me.
That should be like, that's what you're supposed to like the that end of the movie. End,
no, yeah.
That should be, she's painting the Dark Stranger and it's Tom.
Yeah, or something.
That's the big reveal.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's what it should have been.
And then you pull out and her room's just covered with different paintings of him and the Dark Stranger. Like,
that would have brought it all together and would have been like, good stuff.
Like, you know how in Rob Zombie's Halloween, you see Michael Myers in his cell and they're like at the sanitarium and like his walls covered in the masks he's been making, like that. And like, this is her like hyper focus obsession is like revealing this information.
If that had been the end of this movie, I would have been like, bravo.
Right.
That's solid.
But instead, we're treated to a rapid fire orgy of violence where the movie basically recuts a trailer of all the
Recaps the movie. Recaps the movie.
Yeah. That's all the gory deaths of the movie. And then it really cheaps out at the end because it replays the first shot of the movie, which is her wandering down the in the sanitarium hallway, telling us basically that like the Dark Stranger is out there. Yeah. His legions have now gone into the cities and they're coming for you. Yep. And it's very apocalyptic.
But no one will listen. No one will hear you scream.
Yep. The end.
The end.
That's okay. All right. Well, I guess we're gonna let you folks know what our thoughts are on this movie and whether or not you should watch it.
Real quick, what do you think the most expensive purchase for this movie was?
That bed, the swinging bed.
What do you
actually
think it was?
I'll go with it.
Most expensive purchase.
Yeah. Now, obviously, they rented a lot of things, but purchase. What do you think the most expensive purchase was?
I couldn't even tell you. I'm trying to think. I mean, obviously, they had. I'm assuming the house was not a location. It was a set. I don't know. What was most expensive?
Tom's suit.
Oh, really?
Really? Yeah. So that was a found location that they just got into a house. And okay. So they were able to,
To go it was there. A nice suit, even though it had a ridiculous dick print. But it was a good suit.
No. That's right. We missed the whole, he's accosted on the streets and all this other stuff. And chasing zombie, like chasing the police officer. One of them, there's two of them just shooting at the zombies at one point. As they're getting overrun, and then one of them turns into a zombie and kills the other one.
Apparently, there were real cops that weren't paid for this.
Oh, really?
And this is rumor, but they pulled over Michael Greer and wouldn't let him go until they got paid for the movie.
Good.
Well, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
All right, so we will go around the table, tell you what we thought of tonight's movie, Messiah of Evil. But first, we're going to hear from you. Because we're going to read some of your mail. And in order to do that, we're going to have to summon our mailman, Igor. Bring us the mail.
Masters, the mail. I've got the mail. So many letters. Our followers are rising.
Why, thank you, Igor. Has he been to
the
point?
Is he the Messiah of evil?
He's a Messiah. We just don't know what of.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's nice to be a Messiah of something, I guess, right?
Yeah. I think only he thinks.
Damn.
I think
Igor's only he just throwing that. The mail around over here. Just dropping it left and right.
He's whipping it at us tonight.
He claims he's a Messiah. I think only he believes that, though.
Yeah.
Well, we should let the good folks at home know how they can participate in this interactive portion of our show by following along on Facebook.
Facebook.com/SaturdayNightFreakShow.
Or X.
@SatFreakShow.
Or by email.
SaturdayNightFreakShow@yahoo.com.
Or on Instagram and Threads @SaturdayNightFreakShow. About tonight's movie, The Messiah of Evil, Attack of the 20th Century, writes in and says it's got two of the creepiest memorable deaths in 70s horror, the grocery store scene and the movie theater scene. Both are masterfully executed.
Okay. I think they're cool.
All right.
I think it leaves you wanting more.
The last week we watched a movie called The Butterfly Effect. Travis Legler writes in and says, I was completely, oh, so we're going to spoil the ending, the multiple endings of The Butterfly Effect. So you want to skip ahead about, I don't know, a minute and a half here. But Travis Legler says, I was completely in sync and having the same reaction in real time as Holly with the description of the ending of this movie. I've only known the death in the womb ending. Which as much as I love viewing the making of documentaries, deleted scenes, trailers for movies, this is one I never knew had a different ending. And I'm not really sure there was a good way to end this movie that wasn't on a downer note. That's right, because we said most of you who saw The Butterfly Effect apparently saw it on home video in the director's cut, which has a different ending than the theatrical version, which is the one that's on the the streaming services now. They've got the original theatrical back.
Yep. So I didn't see that ending coming.
How many endings does that movie have? I think we established in the week since.
Was it Michaela four?
Four. Yes, because at least there's four different IMDb listings for the alternate ending. And they have names like the sappy ending, the fucked up ending, like that. Like, they each have like the Butterfly Effect alternate ending colon and then a tie. I couldn't believe it.
It's literally the end of Wayne's World.
Yeah. Now it's a super happy ending. Yeah.
Clue where you could get one of the, but I did notice on the IMDb, the Death in the Wound ending got the highest rating.
It is the best one for how ridiculous that movie is.
It's the most appropriate for that movie.
That movie's so stupid and so ridiculous, you might as well end it on a ridiculous note like that, you know?
I agree.
Well, Joey Blythe says, I watched the original movie in theaters, and then later on, when it came on demand, I told my mom it was pretty good and she should watch it. I started it not realizing I played the extended alternate ending and got to the scene where the mom is talking about almost losing him in the womb, and I thought, I don't remember this. Then we got to the scene where he kills himself with his own umbilical cord. Holy shit, that was bleak.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, even if you go with like the quote unquote happy ending, like the one we watched, does it really matter when the whole movie was so fucking bleak to begin with?
Matter.
Like, so you might as well double
doesn't
down matter. On it, right?
There should definitely be a trigger warning for that alternate ending, though.
Yeah. And well, Michael Whitaker, so I'm not entirely sure which ending he's speaking of here. Mm-hmm. So I'll read his message. He says, I actually give credit to the filmmakers for picking a less downer ending that still fundamentally accomplished the same conclusion as the original one. You have to admit it's the same outcome.
I think he's talking about the one we watched because they were never in each other's lives.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So the names of the endings are the happy sappy ending, the stalker ending, which what is that one?
That's
that
where
a different
he follows
one?
Her.
Okay. That's, but then what's the happy one?
The happy sappy is the one we saw
where they just keep walking.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then director's cut ending and then deleted ending.
Which we don't know what the deleted ending is.
Yeah.
The director's cut is the womb.
The womb.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. The week before, we watched a movie called The Prophecy. And Richard Kratzer says, because we posted some photos from the movie, there's a scene with Viggo Mortensen as Lucifer and the little goblin he's got with him. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
As they're sitting there. And Richard Kratzer
says, "Demon, not a goblin, Colin."
He says, "Lucifer's friend is how I imagine Igor looks on a Saturday night when he goes out stepping."
Yep.
That's accurate. Yeah.
He's just bobbing back and forth.
Yep.
Very true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all, each of you, for writing in. We really appreciate it. Now we're going to go around the table, tell you what
Colin.
We thought of. Oh man.
What did you think? Sorry, there's only two of us. So, Messiah of Evil.
I feel like I'm somehow going to be hypocritical by not recommending this movie because there are several others from this era with a similar vibe that make about as much sense that I do like. So then you're like, okay, well, then you have to explain why you didn't like this one if you're going to go and recommend some of those other ones. I think the problem that I have is that it just feels so disjointed and completely made up that it doesn't make a lick of sense. Even, you know, when you're sitting here trying to work it out after the fact. So then, right, if you're like, okay, it doesn't make any sense, but it wasn't supposed to make sense, Colin. It's supposed to be atmospheric mood thing. It's supposed to feel like a nightmare that you can't wake up from. And that usually seems to be like a fallback position for a lot of filmmakers when they can't, like, they just, you know, like, they don't do the hard work to figure out, like, how a logical story works out, or, you know, or don't put in the effort to make their symbols understandable. You know, I mean, I get, like, you put symbols in there so people who recognize this stuff will go, like, oh, that means this and that means that. So somebody somewhere is going to explain it to me.
Yeah.
I'm sure. It's all about this. So either I'm dense. I don't think that it's there. I think that it's a movie that it feels like they got halfway through it. It feels like they had problems making it. It feels like, and credit to the writers for making up a lot of it in the dialogue or in the voiceover to have a movie to eventually release to drive-ins and whatever in 1974. So, but I don't think, there's not enough there. Like, all the set pieces kind of leave you wanting. It doesn't make any sense. It feels some derivative in a lot of ways of other stuff that you've seen or read. So I think I'm going to pass on the Messiah of Evil. I'm going to pass on Messiah of Evil. Michaela, what did you think?
Well, Colin and I don't know if I can't remember if I mentioned it. Colin and I had seen this previously because we watched it when the Elvira thing happened. And when Holly, when you picked this, Colin and I kind of exchanged a look because I remember you and I talking about it and being like, I don't get it. I don't get the hype around this movie. Because, like, when Elvira did it, everyone was like, fuck yeah, Messiah of Evil. There was so much. The fandom came out hard for this movie. Yeah. And I think we did it a disservice because I know I watched the Elvira in order. Messiah of the Evil was the last one. And coming off of City of the Dead and then going into Messiah of Evil is a big disservice to that movie. So, but I think my expectations were totally in the wrong place the first time I watched it, because based on the title and based on it coming after City of the Dead, I thought it was going to be a Satanist movie, and it's not. And that's fine. That's not the movie's fault, but that's definitely what I thought it was going to be. So I was disappointed the first time I saw it, and I had a really hard time engaging with it the first time I saw it. I remember I kept falling asleep, and I was just like, I was bored by it. And this time I enjoyed it more definitely than I did last time. But I agree, Colin. I think it's a little too meandering, and it's a little shoddily put together, and it just, there's not enough meat on the bones here for me. So I'm going to pass on it too. But I do like about the Freak Show in general is that every week I come and I'm like, Colin, you seen this random movie from the 60s or 70s? And you usually have. And if you if you haven't, you usually have a good reason for why you haven't, you know? But I remember you and I felt like we were the only people that didn't get it when Elvira covered it.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad people like it, but it's not for me. But I'm also like, I don't hate it. This is not the worst movie I've ever seen. I just don't have strong feelings either way about this movie, I feel like. But Holly, I see why you brought it. And I, like, you know, it's always worth dissecting here. So, but I'm going to pass on it. But it's a light pass. Whatever. Holly, what'd you think?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I had not seen this movie. I just saw bits of it online. I saw the trailers. I read a little bit about it. And then I saw people raving about it as well. But I completely agree with you. I think it's not a horrendous movie. It's not offensive. I think visually there's some really beautiful things in it. Some of the shots are really cool. Some of the fashion and the art, it's really cool. I actually took several pictures during that. I was like, I'm going to paint that. And that's kind of one of the reasons I brought it, is because I saw stylistically like what it looked like. I'm like, I want to watch this movie. So that part, it didn't disappoint. There was a lot of really beautiful imagery to it that I really liked. But it's the 70s, and there's a lot of movies that has really beautiful imagery that you could watch. I like the vibe of this movie for sure. Definitely. It's got a really cool vibe. But I think it's just misplaced. It's just, they could have done so much more with it. I read that there was more to like the Messiah part, and like the dark stranger was actually going to be like the son of Satan. And I was like, okay, well, yes. Like, those are the elements that this was missing.
Right.
Those are the things that would have made it really cool. If it was like a satanic movie and you had these things, like, that would have been really cool. And I thought we were going to get that, because the dark stranger, when we see the clips, like, you can tell it's played by the same guy that played Tom. I was like, okay, yes, I'm on board. It's going to be Tom. This is great. And it just doesn't play out like that. So it's disappointing. So I agree. I don't understand the hype behind this movie because it is a very slow movie. It's not exciting. There's some cool moments. I like the grocery store scene. I like the theater scene, but it still falls short. It doesn't give you what you want. It's not a satisfying movie by any means. So, although it's not terrible, I agree. It's a light pass.
It is a good poster.
It is a really good poster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of really cool stuff to look at in this movie.
And I think the poster title is what got me. Like, seeing the poster and seeing the title, I was like, ooh, that's going to be badass.
No, that's what sold me. When I picked this, I was like, oh, I need to check this movie out. I'm not going to recommend it, but it wouldn't hurt to, like, turn it on in the background and maybe turn some music on with it. Like, just kind of watch it in the background. If you're like an artistic person, it could be inspiring to you. It was to me. But as a movie, you could probably pass. You're not missing much. There are other movies from the 70s you should watch.
Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of people probably did have it on in the background and they were at the drive-in or whatever. It feels like it's one of those movies that, like, probably, you know, played on late night, you know, horror hosted shows or something like that, and so people caught it. It have like a, I mean, I think like the drive-by kind of criticism of it is going to be like it was haunting or it was atmospheric, right? They'll just throw those.
And it's like, yes, it is atmospheric, but it's not enough.
That
atmosphere does not a movie make, you know?
Yeah, like you gotta have a little more. I just got a really great art book of Sofia Coppola, all of her movies, and it's a gorgeous book, and I was looking through the Marie Antoinette section. I'm like, that's a movie where there's very little plot, but atmospheric and like stylistically it's so beautiful that you don't need it.
Some movies can be about the atmosphere.
You can do it, but it falls short in this movie,
right?
You know.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's Messiah of Evil. Next week on the Saturday Night Freak Show, we're gonna watch a movie that's chosen by
Michaela. What are we watching next week?
We're going to watch a movie that traumatized a generation, Final Destination 2.
No one could ever drive on
a
highway
again.
We all know why.
All right. The second Final Destination that we've done on the show.
Yes.
All right. Final Destination 2 coming up next week on the Saturday Night Freak Show. We hope you'll join us for that. And until then, ladies and germs, the basement is going dark.